And I want to read to you from verse 15 of John 18 through verse 27. It goes like this. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside the door. Now the other disciple who had known the high priest came back, spoke to a servant girl on duty there and brought Peter in. You aren't one of this man's disciples, are you? She asked. I am not, said Peter. It was cold, and the servants and officials stood out around the fire to keep warm. And Peter was standing there with them, warming himself. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. I have spoken openly to the world, Jesus replied. I've always taught in the synagogues and at the temple where all the Jews come together. I have not said anything in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. And when Jesus had said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. Is this the way that you answer the high priest, he demanded. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Meanwhile, Simon Peter was still standing there warming himself. Now, remind you, he's in the same courtyard that Jesus is in. Simon Peter was standing there warming himself. So they asked him, you aren't one of his disciples too, are you? And he denied it, saying, I'm not. And one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him, didn't I see you with him in the garden? Again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, a rooster began to crow. Would you pray with me? Lord, this is an epic fail. And I have had these two. Certainly, Peter's is pretty high level. It's recorded in black and white, and people from every generation since then have read it. But all of us have experienced epic fails where we felt we could not recover. And yet Peter, in the midst of this humiliation and failure, goes on to become someone great in your kingdom on this earth. And I think that's so hopeful, and I'm so grateful for that, Lord. And so I ask you right now that you would speak to us in this kind of avenue of things. Where we have failed and where our failures and our sins dog us, accuse us, shame us, and that you would pull us out, or maybe even more, that you would be in these feelings and these thoughts and all of this with us. Jesus, come and speak to us, we pray, in Jesus, in your name, amen. Have you ever encountered or gone through something, some kind of epic failure? An epic failure such that you felt like you might never recover from that? Have you ever experienced anything like that before? Think for a moment. Yeah, I see that hand. God bless you. Epic fails. It's a word that the millennial generation has coined, I believe, but I think it's appropriate because it's a failure of epic proportions, and that's something that all of us want to avoid almost at all cost. As I think about epic failures, I think about a giant wooden horse rolled into a city and an epic failure associated with that. I think of Constantinople, the great city of the head of the Roman Empire. It was conquered because someone accidentally left the doors unlocked. Epic fail. France took 10 years and billions of francs to build what's called the Maginot Line, a great bunker that extended 950 miles in between them and what they thought was going to be the pursuing Germans. Only the Germans just said, okay, we can't go over that, so we just go around it. And so they went around it and conquered France. Decca Records passed on signing a group called the Beatles. Ron Wayne sold his 10% stock, his 10% share in Apple Computer for $800. That same investment now would be worth $35 billion. Yahoo turned down a chance to buy Google for $1 million. Google is now worth $200 billion. Epic failure. Epic failure. I recall years ago, and I'm not sure if this is, I've got the right guy on this, but IBM had hired a CEO. The board had voted him in, and his first decision right out of the gate cost the company something like $200 million. And someone asked the board member, "Are you going to fire him?" And he said, "I just spent $200 million educating him. I'm not going to fire him." Epic fails. Have you had an epic fail? Or have you had a few, perhaps? I have. Epic failures. Here we see Peter in epic fail mode. And this is all exacerbated because of his insistence before that he would go anywhere with Jesus and he would even die for Jesus. So now he's got that. Only hours before, I mean, that's not even 2, 3, 4 hours before, he says these things and then he denies Jesus. Not once, not twice, but 3 times. He goes down in flames. And so what is here for us? I think in Peter's epic fail, it reveals God to us in a very unique way. It reveals, for one, what God endures for loving us. That is, and I'm going to use the old term, love suffers long, or he suffers long. It reveals how he relates to us in our pain. He empathizes. He knows what it's like to be rejected by the people that he loves. It reveals how he knows we will fail in advance and does not give up on us, that he knows and even believes in us. It reveals how our epic fails do not necessarily have to define us, and therefore we have hope. And it reveals Peter's epic fail teaches us, and from it we learn, and that's where we'll conclude. Now, setting this up, and I'm not going to read the passage because it's fairly simple, and I'm going to, instead of commenting on the middle portion where Jesus is standing before the high priest and the Sanhedrin in a smaller setting right now, not the full Sanhedrin. He's in a smaller setting, and he said, "I've not kept anything secret." And what we see in that, just by as a side note here, is that we see that Jesus, he's not trying to keep, you know, he's not trying to keep his truth from us, but in fact, if we don't want to see the truth, we won't see it. That's what's being said there. If we don't want to see the truth, we will not see it. And I can testify to the truthfulness of that. Now, in setting this up, Jesus knew that he was going to be going to the cross, and through that, it would change everything. Everything. Sin's grip would be broken. Evil's stranglehold would be demolished and loosed. Death would no longer have the final word. And this is all being set, it's all coming in the events that are now unfolding. In the last 24 hours, he has gathered with his inner circle in an upper room. He's washed their feet, even the feet of his betrayer. He's predicted that Peter would deny him 3 times. He's spoken to them that the Spirit will come, that where he goes, and he's referring to the cross, when he goes to the cross, the Spirit will come and will continue the work of Jesus down through the ages, through these people that are sitting with him, and then through all of those people that believe through them. He's spoken to them about this, and he said, "My death is only a beginning. It is not an end." And then he prays. He prays for them, and we hear from him this conversation at the center of the universe. God speaking to God. At the end of that prayer, you hear a noise. And it's a rabble coming in to arrest Jesus. He's been arrested, and we saw several weeks ago that Peter decided to take matters into his own hand. He cuts off an official's slave, one of the high priest's slaves' ears. In another gospel, we find that Jesus picks it up, puts it back on. This is an incredible kind of a setting, but Jesus is now being brought to the high priest. And the first thing that we see in this passage is what God endures for loving us. And John is over and over wanting us to see that Jesus comes, that the God of love comes to us, and we reject him. That's humanity's general response to God, is to resist him and to reject him. And so therefore, what we see is a God who suffers long. Some theologians have gone so far as to say that this is the suffering God, and that's true. It is true. That here, out of deep love, we see that God took on flesh, entered all the way into our darkness. All the way. He didn't just do a drive-by. Hey, I love you. Hey, kids, come back to me. And here we see once more that he came to his own, but his own people did not receive him. He came to his own, but his own did not receive him. The religious elite, we see, they pressed him, they contested him, they opposed him, they plotted his death. Judas, one of his disciples, betrayed him. But here we see something different. This is a BFF. This is Jesus' best friend. And his best friend disowns him, not once, not twice, but three times. And even though he knows this is going to happen, what do you think goes through the mind of Jesus? Do you think he remains sitting on the sidelines sort of passively? You hear your best friend disown you three times. Now, my mind naturally goes to, gosh, what would that have felt like? Because Luke records it that when Peter actually denies him the last time, actually quite loudly, that Peter and Jesus' eyes meet. And in my heart, I think, Peter is going down in flames here, and I don't know that I could deal with that. But what did Jesus feel? Because this is what the heart of God goes through, because he loves you and he loves me and he loves every person on this planet through all of time, yet is rejected, even disowned. The Lord of love, disowned by his own best friend. Think. That would have been crushing. And we see Jesus investing in real relationships, and so therefore, just like you and me, real relationships can hurt us. And in this case, it does. This is God, in deep compassion, coming to rescue us, and yet at the same time, in a sense, we don't want to be rescued. It's sort of like, in my mind, it draws pictures of Pinocchio, where we're entrapped and enslaved and distorted by our own desires, almost unknowingly, but we begin to distort and morph. And we love the appetite more than we love the help, and we really don't want the help all that badly. That the Lord of love, let's just say it this way, love comes to our rescue, but we don't want to be rescued. And 9 times out of 10, when I share Jesus with somebody out in anywhere besides here, that's the response. 9 times out of 10, people do not want to be rescued. That they are content in what they have. Yet, well, and in fact, this is how John describes it, that light has come into the world, but people love darkness instead of light. That's where the marriage kind of relationship is, that we're married to our darkness. And so I want to ask this question and just have you think about this for just a moment. What happens in the heart of God when people that he loves reject and disown him? Humanity. What happens in the heart of God? Think for a moment. Some of us would think, well, God is just somehow not that engaged, and so therefore he would remain on the sideline passively. Others of you might think that, well, maybe God gets mad. He pulls back and he smites them and just blows everybody to Mars. But he does not. He does not do that. Instead, he moves closer. That we reject him, he moves closer. We put up resistance, God moves closer. I love the way that Francis Thompson, in his poem, The Hound of Heaven, describes this, that God is relentless in pursuing us. He pursues us, even though we reject him. And so therefore we say with this, with the way that Paul describes love in 1 Corinthians 13:4, love suffers long. Love suffers long. And so out of this pain that Jesus experiences from his own best friend, we see secondly that he is near to us in our pain, that he empathizes, that he feels our pain. Now, I think that sometimes, and I've heard this, and I think that I've had even some of this in my mindset over the years, is that we treat God more like Santa Claus than like our Father in heaven. That somehow he sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, he knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. I mean, hello. And somehow that God is sitting there observing you from afar. He's sort of looking at you, trying to catch you doing something wrong. And this is a common view of people that I talk to, both inside and outside the church, is that we think of God more as Santa Claus, but I think more that more times than not, when we think of that, we're thinking that God is somehow just the big gift giver. But the reality is the human heart says that God is looking to catch you getting it wrong. What if he was actually looking to catch you getting it right? It is one thing to look on at people's suffering from the outside. We do that on a daily basis. We turn on the news and we see video documentaries of places that are impoverished in the world. We see devastating earthquakes and tsunamis and hurricanes and the devastation, the human toll of those things, and we look from the outside. But it is quite another thing to enter into someone's pain and to feel that pain. But this is indeed what the God of the universe has done. He took on flesh to come all the way to us, wrap his arms around us. And so, therefore, the writer of Hebrews says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but who was tempted in all things the same way as we are, yet without sin." In light of this, or therefore, let us approach with confidence the throne of grace in order that we may receive help in our time of need. Now, the reality is that Jesus is moved by what is going on inside of you. And that was a game changer for me. Wait a minute. I'm not going through these things by myself. And I think a lot of times we say, you know, you have problems, come to Jesus and give those problems to him like he's somewhere else, out there somewhere. But he's not. He is right here. He is that close. He is not standing out there sometime and saying, human beings, if you would just come to me, your lives would be better off. He's come all the way to us. You've never spent a second in your life without Jesus imminently close to you, ever, ever. He's that close, and he's that close all the time. The only thing that changes is your awareness of that closeness. That he is that close to you, and he's that close to me, and it is all out of love. I love the way that Mark puts this in the story of the leper, and this is at the very beginning of Mark's gospel. It says, "A man with leprosy came and knelt in front of Jesus, begging him to be healed. If you are willing, you can heal me and make me clean." Mark records it this way, Jesus is moved with compassion. He reached out and touched him. "I am willing," he said, "be clean," or "be healed." Now this term, it's one word, this move with compassion is the Greek word splunkna. It's this word that describes a sort of visceral response inside of us that when something happens and we feel it in our gut, something deeply in our gut, and it is this kind of this response welling up. You see this over and over again with Jesus. He looks at the crowds. He feels compassion. That means his tears well up. His eyes well up with tears as he looks at them. Compassion flows from him because he meets us exactly where he are. He feels your feelings. He empathizes with everything that you are and that you go through. And so your epic fails. You've never been alone in your epic fail. You have only been accompanied by the one who really matters. Every single time. And this is Peter's experience, and it can be yours and mine. That brings us to the third point there, that Jesus knows that Peter will fail. He knows that we will fail, but he does not give up on us. He knows and believes. Now, it's kind of an odd thing to say that Jesus believes in us because he's the one that we're supposed to believe in. But think about this for a moment. It's true especially when we fail, that the Lord doesn't give up, that he sees something that probably isn't quite there yet. And that's called belief. And that the Lord of glory sees you, and he knows that even in your epic fails, that those don't last. I love the way that earlier on when Jesus is predicting this, this is how this goes with Jesus predicting Peter's denial. "Where I am going," he says, "you cannot follow me now, but you will follow later." When Peter asks, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I mean, I can just hear him. He's a fisherman, you know, he's a man's man. I will lay down my life for you." And Jesus answered him, "Will you really lay down your life for me? Very truly I tell you, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times." Three times. Jesus knows that Peter will fail him. Well, that doesn't keep it from hurting. But he knows that this will happen. And think about this for a moment. He knows that Peter will fail, but he knows his life will still have purpose after the failure. This same guy, open mouth, insert foot, Peter, you know this one? He's the one that speaks and then thinks. But Peter, this same guy, he becomes the bishop of the Church of Rome. He leads tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to Christ. He becomes the anchor of the church. This same guy, after his epic fail, I don't know about you, but I love this about the Bible. Have you thought about that? Who are the heroes aside from Jesus? All the rest of the heroes, then they have feet made of clay. I mean, David, he's the high king. He's a murderer and an adulterer. Yikes. Those are not hero qualities, right? Am I being too full court press here, or what's happening? You guys are like... No, the reality is that these heroes, they fail and they botch it in a very serious way. Now, Peter's denial left a mark, but not forever. What's your epic fail? Where have you failed in an epic way? Think. Was it in a relationship? All kinds of different directions with that. Was it in school? Was it in not fulfilling someone's expectations? Was it a divorce, or was it some besetting sin or marital infidelity? What is your epic fail? What is that thing that follows you like a ball and chain, that you are bringing it with you everywhere you go? What is your epic fail? Think. I know epic fail well. Those of you that know me, you know my story. I've failed a lot, not just a little. But God has not given up on me. And I want to ask you to take a look around this room for just a moment, because there's a lot of epic failed people all around you. You're in good company. The only one who isn't epic fail, and it isn't the Apostle Paul, it's Jesus. He's the only non-epic fail human being that's ever walked the planet. No, we're in good company, all of us. Now, some of us have not epic failed quite as bad, but we still have epic failed. And I think it's kind of a beautiful thing. I like the way that one of my friends put this. Losing is winning if it turns you around. Losing is winning if it turns you around. Jesus knows that Peter will fail. And he also knows that you will fail. And it doesn't deter him from thinking that that will not be the last of you. That will not be the thing that defines you. Now, that doesn't mean that your failure is no biggie and that we should just ignore it. But what it does mean is that your and my failures and our sins do not catch God by surprise, ever. They do not catch him by surprise. That he is still there with us and he sees you through love, because that's the only way he knows how to see you. He loves you and he sees you through the eyes of love. That brings us to our fourth point. That our epic fails do not define us, therefore we have hope. I love the way that Luke writes this in his recounting of this part of the story. He says, Jesus is speaking to Peter, and he says, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked or demanded to sift you as wheat." Now, let's just give a little brief parenthesis here. And the idea here is that he got it. He got permission. And so Peter is being sifted, but Jesus says, "But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, when you have turned back, when your epic fail moment is over, strengthen your brothers." And so therefore, we're calling this message Epic Fail Part 1, because this is not the end of the story. It isn't for Peter, and it's not the end of the story for you either. Now, I'm incredibly happy about that. Because these guys that are the heroes of the faith, these guys they have failure written all over them, and yet God has taken them and brought them into this new land of freedom. Peter's life is a beautiful example that epic fails are not fatal, that they do not define you, but they actually bring a fresh sort of humility and dependence on God in the midst of it. That's what these failures do for us. And so today, I think some of you have come into this place full of shame and sadness and judgment and brokenness. Toward yourself, you look at the mirror and you despise what you see. I know this. I have experienced this myself. But that is not how the God of the universe sees you. It is not how he sees you. Would you please hear him on that? Would you let his voice, his presence break through? Some of you thought, you know what, I made it in the building, Bob. That's as good as I got. And I want to say to you, congratulations. You made it in the building. You made it somehow to a place where Jesus is manifested in a more discernible way. But he wants you to hear this. That from his point of view, your epic fails do not define you. Only you determine whether it does or doesn't. Now remember this goofy line. I searched a really good line from the goofy movie, Princess Diaries. The chauffeur guy is saying this to the girl who doesn't believe that she's really royalty and she can't really do it. And he said to her, "No one can make you feel inferior without your consent." That actually is quoting Eleanor Roosevelt. No one can make you feel inferior without your consent. And so Jesus is beckoning us this morning to invite him into this shame and this failure. See what happens. See what happens. It's the last thing. The last thing I see here, and I've been meditating on this for 2 weeks because I've had 2 weeks to meditate on it. And the thing that I see about this that I can't help but say is that Peter's epic fail, it teaches us, and it taught the early church, that through it we learn. And here's what I mean by that. That Peter's denial left a deep impression on the early Christians. They looked at this story because this is handed down in all four Gospels. And this is handed down, and Peter's life and his epic fail is right in front of everybody in black and white. Every Christian who has ever followed Jesus and read the four Gospels has heard Peter's story. And they have said, and the early church took this on and said, we do not want to do this. We want to remain faithful no matter what it cost us. And so the culture started in the early church of martyrdom, where all these opportunities to renounce Jesus and to renounce the faith for both renunciations, big and small. Some of the renunciations were renounce your faith in front of all these people. Others just said, just take a little bit of incense and put it over the fire and say, you know, Hail Caesar. And they wouldn't do it because this particular event in Peter's lives galvanized in them that the nature of the Christian life is a radical life that demands and calls into us a radical loyalty, an allegiance that we do not bend when the culture says you must. This is the Christianity that's handed down to us through the apostles. This is the Christianity that's handed down through us through Peter himself. And the early church bought this. And as a result of that, many of them lost their lives and regularly. Now, there were two major kind of flows of persecution in the Roman Empire under two particular emperors. But then there was, it continued for almost the first 300 years of the church's life. People lost their lives on a regular basis. They were burned at the stake. They were fed to lions. They were impaled. They were boiled in oil. And it was considered a great honor to die for the master. All coming back to Peter's epic fail. It's what we hear at Revelation chapter 12, where it says, they loved not their lives even unto death. And so person after person said, I want to be able to put my life in the place of Jesus. I believe there's great glory and great honor in this. And even though I think for us, we're like, are you crazy? You know, you could get out of this. It's interesting. Curiously, I read over the last week the story of Ignatius of Antioch. And he's a bishop from Antioch, obviously, and he's traveling to Rome to be killed as a martyr. And one of the things that he says in his writings is, do not try to get me out of this. That this is one of the ways that I'm going to show Jesus that I'm really his disciple. Now, you and I would look at that and say, dude, you're nuts. You're totally nuts. But he wrote seven letters, one of them to Rome, and he said to the Romans, don't try to talk anyone out of this. This is the way I want to honor my Lord. Now, curiously, at 313 A.D., Constantine, the emperor at that point in time, he declared an edict that stopped, the Edict of Milan, stopped Christian persecution. And what ended up happening was that over a very short period of time, that this quality of discipleship and this radical love for God and this desire to be in community and in an otherworldly kind of community in this world, now all of a sudden it's popular, it's acceptable. What do we do with that? And as Christianity became more and more free, and it became more and more privileged. And as it became more and more privileged, it became shallower and more superficial. And interestingly enough, movements began to arise here and there that still wanted to greet this, even though you are not going to be martyred for your faith anymore. How do we get a hold of this radical nature of following Jesus? Because it is so counterculture, so not of this world. How do we do that? And so you have monastic movements that pop up here and there. And that's all, and it's distorted, or perhaps if you look at their doctrine and the ways that they see, you might think, well, they really got that wrong. But what they were responding to was that now Christianity, since Christianity is free, it's really low quality and it's low cost. But the real article is not. And we want that real article. So in Egypt, thousands of people went out to Anthony in the desert. Actually, it's estimated that about 100,000 people went out to be with this guy in the desert of Egypt to get away from this pathetic kind of nature of Christianity within the cities and to have a radical walk with God. And they were willing to sell all to be able to do that. And as twisted as it seems to us, it's beautiful. Because following Jesus has always been radical. Let me say that one more time. Following Jesus has always been radical. It's never stopped being radical. Now, we might have massaged all the hard edges off of it, but it's always been radical. And I just want to ask you this morning, do you recall a time in your faith journey when you are willing to follow Jesus in this radical sort of a way? Now, I'm not just saying, just go back to that point, click your heels and say, there's no place like home, there's no place like home. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the essential gospel is a gospel that's not of this world. It's a gospel that means that we don't hate our enemies, we love our enemies. It's a gospel that means that we're reconcilers and we're peacemakers in an age where reconciliation or where polarity is the norm. And I don't know if you've been following the politic over the last number of weeks, but it's gotten worse and worse and worse and worse. And the polarization and the hate, our country is full of it. And we need to be people who are peacemakers in an age of hatred. Even when we might consider that we hold the ideological high ground, we still are called by God to be peacemakers and to be Jesus within this culture. And that is radical. It doesn't matter what culture you live in and what era. It's still our call. Now, for some of you, some of you are going, oh, no, Bob, I feel condemned and everything on this. Others of you are starting to come alive again. You're thinking, wait, that's right. And I believe that God has called me into that. But Jesus is speaking to each one of us. He's saying, would you come and follow me? These 12 guys that went and followed him, and then this entourage around them as well, they all knew that this would be costly and it would be worth it. And Jesus says to us this morning, come and follow me. Learn from Peter's epic fail. Learn from your epic fails. Now, this is not a pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but it is a turn. Turn back to God with all you got. So let me reiterate and close. The first thing that we see is what God endures for simply loving us, that he suffers long. Secondly, that he's near to us in our pain, that he actually empathizes, that he feels our pain, that he knows that we will fail and that he still does not give up on us. That is, he believes and knows us. He knows what we will go through and he believes us. That our epic fails do not define us. Therefore, we have hope, and that Peter's epic fail teaches us, and therefore we learn from it. Two things in, just in concluding here. I believe that Jesus is calling us out of the swamp of failure and sin in this. But he's not standing on the outside of the swamp saying, hey, come here. He's saying, would you recognize me right next to you? Grab a hold of my hand and let me walk you out. It's a very different animal. Where are you defined by your epic failures? And then lastly, I think for me, this sort of puts me back into a Garden of Eden type of a dynamic. And this is the imagery that comes to my mind, is that God comes walking in the garden and Adam and Eve, they hide. They hide from the one that loves them. Curious. Because that's what sin and failure does to us, is it causes us to hide. And the Lord said, would you stop hiding from me? I'm right here. So would you stand with me? Just want to lead us in a short prayer.